Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Thomas Sines, President and General Counsel with the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, who discusses rulings issued by the U.S. Supreme Court last week on the U.S. Census and partisan gerrymandering. Jeff Cohen, co-founder of the online activist group RootsAction.org, who talks about his group's Bad Blues report that encourages progressives to challenge incumbent corporate Democrats who no longer represent the interests of their constituents, and excerpts of talks by Reverend Vicki Flippin, pastor of a Connecticut sanctuary church, and Angie Idrovo of Connecticut Students for a Dream at a recent pro-immigrant rally in New Haven, opposing President Trump's punitive immigration policies. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Reuters reports that teams of hackers connected to the Chinese Ministry of State Security had penetrated the Hewlett-Packard Company's cloud computing service and used it as a launchpad to attack customers and steal corporate and government secrets in order to boost Chinese economic interests. The hacking operation was named Cloud Hopper. Other corporations reportedly hacked include IBM, Tata Consulting Services, and DXC Technology, a spinoff of Hewlett-Packard. Records and interviews found that the corporate and government response to the attacks was undermined because service providers withheld information from hacked clients out of concern over their corporate legal liability and bad publicity. That failure, intelligence officials say, calls into question Western institutions' ability to share information in an effective way to defend against elaborate cyber invasions. Even now, many victims may not be aware they were hit. Former Guatemalan First Lady Sandra Torres won the first round of the impoverished Central American nation's presidential election on June 16th, amid growing voter apathy and disgust over corruption and violence. The barring of two front-running candidates, former Attorney General Thelma Aldana and Zuri Rios, daughter of former military dictator Efrain Rios Montt, as well as the indictment of a third candidate on drug smuggling charges, opened the political space to long-shot candidates like Torres. In 2015, Guatemalan voters had high hopes of cleaning up widespread government corruption after the president and vice president were charged with fraud. Although the UN backed the establishment of an independent commission to weed out corruption, over time, voter apathy replaced hope for change as tens of thousands of Guatemalans chose to seek a new life in the United States. 4 years ago, Torres lost the presidency to TV comedian Jimmy Morales, who is currently under investigation for illegal campaign financing. But Torres's center-left UNE party is also facing a probe for accepting $2.5 million in illegal campaign contributions. On August 11th, Torres will face former prisons commissioner Alejandra Giammatell in the final round of Guatemala's presidential election. In South Bend, Indiana, the hometown of presidential candidate Mayor Pete Buttigieg, many homeless people often live in small camps in the woods, which the city has often closed down when they get too large. The city of 102,000 has shown little imagination in dealing with homelessness and urban poverty. According to the New Yorker magazine, South Bend has just a handful of homeless shelters with a capacity for only about 100 people. At the start of his second term, Buttigieg established a working group on homelessness, which gave the mayor a 20-page report of recommendations. Although the city had set aside funds for homeless programs, critics say that the mayor has failed to follow through and that he has not made the problem enough of a priority. In his book published this year, Shortest Way Home, Buttigieg boasts of demolishing hundreds of abandoned buildings in South Bend. But Sarah Rankin of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project sees a stark landscape in South Bend with a functional exile of people of color and visibly poor folks. Eric Tarz, the legal director at the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, says of Buttigieg, "For me, a progressive candidate is somebody who's not just talking about the forgotten middle class, but the truly forgotten poor." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The Trump administration's drive to include a question on citizenship in the 2020 U.S. Census came to an end after the U.S. Supreme Court issued a ruling on June 27th that temporarily blocked inclusion of the question until the administration could present an honest explanation for its insertion. Previous explanations by Trump administration officials were contradicted by several pieces of evidence, including documents from a now-deceased GOP strategist who advocated for the inclusion of the citizenship question because it would, quote, clearly be a disadvantage to the Democrats and advantageous to Republicans and non-Hispanic whites. Census data is used to determine both federal and state legislative district maps and the allocation of hundreds of billions of dollars in federal funds. After the high court decision was handed down, Mr. Trump urged a delay in conducting the 2020 census to give his administration more time to present a plausible explanation to the justices. But on July 2nd, Trump's Justice Department threw in the towel and announced that census forms would now be published without the citizenship question. Your reporter spoke with Thomas Sines, president and general counsel of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, which was a plaintiff in a parallel lawsuit before a federal court in Maryland, attempting to block inclusion of the citizenship question in next year's census. Here, Sines discusses the outcome of the census case and another important ruling on partisan gerrymandering.
So there are a number of challenges to the citizenship question after Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross last year indicated that at the last minute they would be adding a citizenship question to Census 2020. Maldiv has one of those cases in the District Court of Maryland, which is where the Census Bureau is located. And our case, like the others, resulted in a district court judge concluding that the administration had acted unlawfully by adding the question as it did with, first of all, a false public reason for why it was adding the question. Second, real questions about whether adding the question would severely undermine the constitutional duty to enumerate all residents in the country. And finally, particularly in our case, a contention that racial discriminatory intent was behind the addition of the question. Now, of those cases, the New York case, which is not Maldiv's case, but is the one that went to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court last week, somewhat unexpectedly, majority concluded that, in fact, the addition of the question violated the Administrative Procedures Act precisely because what Secretary Ross gave as the reason for adding the question was a falsehood, a lie, a pretext. And they have given, the court has given an opportunity for the administration and Secretary Ross particularly to come forward with a public justification that is truthful and legitimate. But in the meantime, our racial intent question was basically strengthened by some newly discovered evidence a few weeks ago. And so we are back in court in Maryland after a remand from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals with the possibility of getting a final decision that it was racially discriminatory. And if it was racially discriminatory in intent to add the question, that can't be fixed, and the citizenship question will be permanently off Census 2020.
Thomas, what about accountability for Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross? It seems from all the evidence that he blatantly lied to Congress. What do you think is the correct course of action here in terms of accountability?
Well, were this any other administration than the current one, I think that Wilbur Ross would have resigned in disgrace a long time ago. As more and more evidence comes out that he blatantly lied to the Congress and the public about adding this question, in another administration, that would disqualify him from serving. But in the clown car of a cabinet that we currently have, he is still in place. But clearly, his legitimacy has been completely undermined. If there's anything that a Commerce Secretary should view as sacrosanct, it's the U.S. Census and conducting it in a professional manner. And he has undermined that entirely, in my view, and Maldiv has called for his resignation previously. He has no business continuing to serve in the cabinet.
Thomas, I wanted to briefly talk about the other ruling from the Supreme Court, where the conservative majority ruled that federal courts can no longer hear challenges to states' where partisan gerrymandering of districts has been alleged, it's always been the case where there's a fine line between partisan and racial or ethnic gerrymandering. What is your overview of the impact of this case on our electoral system?
Well, I think it was the inevitable result of the conservative majority that we have currently. Justice Kennedy was the one justice that might have moved to a conclusion that partisan gerrymandering was justiciable, something that federal courts could address. And when he was succeeded by Justice Kavanaugh, I think it's quite clear that really determined the outcome of the partisan gerrymandering cases. I think what it will lead to is every state across the country considering whether to continue to leave in the hands of state legislatures the redrawing of lines for Congress and for the state legislatures themselves. I think we still have to ensure that racial gerrymandering and violations of the Voting Rights Act to dilute the political power of racial minorities are addressed and addressed specifically in those states where too often an intent to diminish the power of a growing minority group like Latinos is masked behind some partisan motive. But we do know from a Texas redistricting case last decade that Maldef brought, the Supreme Court made clear, you can't hide your racial intent behind some partisan motivation if, in fact, race and partisanship overlap so closely, you can't ignore that in addressing voting rights issues. So I think it is a challenge, but we have to make sure that the existing laws, constitutional and statutory, defending the rights of racial minorities, I would say particularly those groups that are growing into significant political power, are protected in this next redistricting round. Historically, legislatures have been very, very closed from public eyes in doing this all-important task of drawing political lines, and that has been unquestionably a major problem in hiding the true motivations, including racial motivations that are unlawful, behind why specific decisions are made, and we've seen that year after year. But I do think in the public there will be very serious consideration about creating independent redistricting commissions to ensure that overly partisan gerrymandering, drawing of lines that is really not a reflection of the political viewpoint distribution in the population is prevented.
That was Thomas Sines, President and General Counsel of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Learn more about the important issues at stake in both the census citizenship question and partisan gerrymandering cases by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Progressive Democrats have seen major electoral victories over the past 2 years. One of the most notable was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's June 2018 primary defeat of incumbent New York Representative Joe Crowley, the fourth most powerful Democrat in the House, who many observers predicted would someday become Speaker of the House. 28-year-old Ocasio-Cortez, a former Bernie Sanders organizer and Democratic socialist, went on to win the November general election and quickly gained national prominence with her outspoken advocacy for the proposed Green New Deal. In this year's primary season, another progressive New York activist, openly queer Latina Tiffany Caban, claimed victory in a six-way race for Queens District Attorney, defeating the Democratic Party machine's chosen candidate. Now, the progressive online activist group RootsAction.org has published a new report titled Bad Blues, Some of the House Democrats Who Deserve to Be Primaried, which includes summaries of the voting records of 15 conservative incumbent Democrats, encouraging progressive challengers to take them on in primary elections. While the group concedes that incumbents are difficult to defeat, they spell out the many benefits of the grassroots organizing that is a necessary part of electoral campaigns. Your reporter spoke with Jeff Cohen, founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College and co-founder of RootsAction.org. Here he discusses the Bad Blues report and explains why he believes it's critical that progressives move now to defeat legislators who no longer represent the interests of their constituents.
there's a lot of congressional districts where they're completely blue. In many of these districts, the voters, the constituents, want their Congress member to move in a progressive direction and stand up for working class and middle class people and stand up for the environment. And what we found in a lot of these blue, very Democratic districts is that the member of Congress representing those districts seems to be owing more loyalty to the corporate donors than to their constituents. Everyone knows about the AOC effect. It wasn't just that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez knocked out a powerful Democrat, 10-term Democrat, fourth in power in the hierarchy within the Democratic Party. It's that her victory has scared a lot of Democrats in office that they better start paying attention to the progressive impulses and needs and wants and desires of their constituents more than their corporate donors. So you have the exciting AOC from Bronx, Queens, Ayanna Pressley, who knocked off a 10-term incumbent in Massachusetts, Ilhan Omar in Minnesota, Rashida Tlaib, the Palestinian-American from Detroit, the city I grew up in. And you have these Congress members, women, people of color, and they don't fall in line behind the corporate leadership of the party. They actually owe their allegiance to the progressive activists that are the base of the Democratic Party. So it's very exciting. You could go further to people that have been in two terms, not first-termers, but two terms, like Ro Khanna from California, who leads on so many peace issues, Pramila Jayapal from Seattle, and she's been a real leader on a lot of corporate regulation issues. So there's this exciting thing happening in Congress where you can see what it would be like if the Democratic Party stood up for working class, middle class, and poor people, fought for the environment, and rejected this kind of alliance with corporate donors and Wall Street donors. So it's an exciting period that we're in, and the idea behind this report, and anyone can go to badblues.org and read the 15 profiles. We just want to keep that process going of churn and bringing young progressive voices into the Democratic Party and getting rid of some of the dead weight, these Congress members that have been in there term after term, and really either they serve corporate interests pretty strongly or they once fought for racial, social, economic justice, and they've just grown tired. Those are the kinds of people we're targeting among these 15 that we chose. And we pointed out there's far more than 15 that need to be primaried.
Jeff, as you note in the report, many of those candidates who come up to challenge incumbent congressmen or congresswomen won't win. It's just that's the track record. Incumbents are very hard to defeat. They have name recognition. They have lines to a lot of campaign cash. What's the argument against folks who say, hey, don't rock the boat. Let's keep the Democrats in power regardless of the very big tent that the Democratic Party is. Let's not engage in a circular firing squad. It's time for unity. What's the benefit? What's the long-run benefit for the progressive movement by challenging these corporate Democrats?
First of all, some of these challengers will win, and it's that crop I described earlier, AOC, Ilhan Omar, Ro Khanna, Pramila. They're shaking things up. So some of them will win. But even if you don't win, and you asked a great question, even if you don't win, a progressive challenge helps unify activists. It teaches electoral skills. So even if you don't knock off the incumbent corporate Democratic member of Congress, it helps you get organized. You can win later elections. It sometimes puts a scare into the Democrat to pay more attention to the constituents, working class and middle class people, rather than the 1% corporate donors. Any strong progressive campaign has a lot of good impacts, even if the corporate Democrat wins out.
That was Jeff Cohen, founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, founder of the Media Watch Group FAIR,
and co-founder of the online activist group RootsAction.org. Find a link to Roots Action's Bad Blues report by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the last week of June, cities and towns around the U.S. held rallies to show their support for immigrants after President Trump directed U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to conduct mass raids to round up migrant families with deportation orders across the country. That order was later delayed by Trump on June 22nd. In New Haven, Connecticut, more than 200 people attended a rally in front of City Hall on June 26th. Those gathered opposed Trump's punitive immigration policies and the dangerous conditions at U.S.-run detention camps. Activists had an additional goal of pressuring New Haven Mayor Tony Harp to commit to supporting a sanctuary ordinance to protect the city's undocumented immigrants. They asked Harp to formally codify an earlier directive to police not to ask persons they come in contact with about their immigration status. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the rally and presents excerpts from two speeches. We first hear from Angie Idrova with Connecticut Students for a Dream. She's followed by the Reverend Vicki Flippin, pastor of New Haven's First and Summerfield United Methodist Church, which has been providing sanctuary to Nelson Pinos at the church building for the past 18 months.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Angie Idrova. And I'm undocumented, unafraid, and here to stay. So I immigrated to this country with my family, with full of dreams and hopes at the age of 12. And as a young undocumented immigrant, I had the experience of fearing deportation. But not only fearing deportation, but also carrying a lot of trauma. Because that's the reality of undocumented children, that's the reality of undocumented citizens that either cross this nation or overstay their visas, or they just stay over because they wanna like become better, right? They wanna sustain their families back home. When I was young, right, I remember going to middle school and think about, what if I come back home and I don't find my parents? What if I come back home and I get to put in a foster home with my two younger siblings, with my two younger brothers. It was very tough and heartbreaking to think about those days when I was only 13 years old, and I had to think about those things. And we're here to demand our legislators and Congress legislators to step up and realize that Trump is just manipulating us and trying to get this money for CBP and ICE to keep dehumanizing and killing our communities.
That was Angie Idrovo with Connecticut Students for a Dream. Next is the Reverend Vicki Flippin, pastor of First and Summerfield United Methodist Church.
It has been our privilege and honor at First and Summerfield to be able to participate in the liberation struggle of so many people, to be able to participate and support the liberation struggle, especially in this year and a half of Nelson Pinos and his family. Free Nelson now! Free Nelson now! Free Nelson now! Free Nelson now! The welfare of our communities is not a bargaining chip. Human beings should never be held hostage in political games.
Yeah!
When children are harmed and neglected, it is not a deterrent, it is abuse. It is inhumanity, it is sin. Yeah. Woo! When I heard a government lawyer defending concentration camps for babies, when I heard this woman trying to argue that children deprived of sleep, deprived of toothbrushes and soap, deprived of humanity and love, arguing that that is somehow sanitary and safe. When I think about Nelson Pinos left to languish in detention in our church for a year and a half, when I hear about what ICE has done in Connecticut, about how it chases people down in our communities, takes parents away from children, breadwinners away from dependents, when families are left without income, without food, evicted from their homes, without any knowledge of where their disappeared loved one is, I wonder, does anybody here believe that what we do in this world matters? Does it matter if we are kind and merciful and just and good? Does it matter? Because some will try to make you think that it doesn't matter, but it does matter. Today, Christ is in an unsafe and unsanitary detention center. This week, Christ is making a plan for his children in case he gets picked up by ICE at work. On Monday of this week, Christ's 23-month-old body was pulled out of a river. That is where Christ is today. And where are we? Connecticut, our communities are not bargaining chips or hostages or instruments of deterrence. And we must do all that we can to protect one another, because you know what? Everything we do and everything we fail to do for one another in this life matters. It matters.
That was the Reverend Vicki Flippin, pastor of New Haven, Connecticut's First and Summerfield United Methodist Church, preceded by Angie Idrovo with Connecticut Students for a Dream. For more information on the National Sanctuary Movement and groups opposing the Trump administration's punitive immigration policies, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, WHYR in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.